I can't believe she would do that to him. He doesn't deserve that. I feel a real sense of disappointment. I feel as though I have been cheated. A familiar ache fills my chest. I have felt this way before. On a larger scale, to a more intense degree, of course, but I remember the quality of the pain. You don't forget it. I found out, the way everyone seems to find out these days, an electronic slip. Sometimes it's a text or a voicemail message. In my case, it was an email. The modern-day lipstick on the collar. It was an accident, really. I wasn't snooping. I wasn't supposed to go near Tom's computer because he was worried I would delete something important by mistake or click on something I shouldn't and let in a virus or a Trojan or something.
Technology's not really your strong point, is it, Rach?
He said, after the time I managed to delete all the contacts in his email address book by mistake. So I wasn't supposed to touch it. But I was actually doing a good thing. I was trying to make amends for being a bit miserable and difficult. I was planning a special 4th anniversary getaway, a trip to remind us how we used to be. I wanted it to be a surprise, so I had to check his work schedule secretly. I had to look. I wasn't snooping. I wasn't trying to catch him out or anything. I knew better than that. I didn't want to be one of those awful, suspicious wives who go through their husband's pockets. Once, I answered his phone when he was in the shower, and he got quite upset and accused me of not trusting him. I felt awful because he seemed so hurt. I needed to look at his work schedule, and he'd left his laptop on because he'd run out late for a meeting. It was the perfect opportunity. So I had a look at his calendar, noted down some dates. When I closed down the browser window with his calendar in it, there was an email account, logged in, laid bare. There was a message at the top from aboyd@cinnamon.com. I clicked. XXXXX. That was it. Just a line of X's. I thought it was spam at first, until I realized that they were kisses. It was a reply to a message he'd sent a few hours before, just after 7, when I was still slumbering in our bed. I fell asleep last night thinking of you. I was dreaming about kissing your mouth, your breasts, the inside of your thighs. I woke this morning with my head full of you, desperate to touch you. Don't expect me to be sane. I can't be. Not with you. I read through his messages. There were dozens, hidden in a folder entitled Admin. I discovered that her name was Anna Boyd, and that my husband was in love with her. He told her so. Often. He told her that he'd never felt like this before, that he couldn't wait to be with her, that it wouldn't be long until they could be together. I don't have words to describe what I felt that day. But now, sitting on the train, I am furious. Nails digging into my palms, tears stinging my eyes. I feel a flash of intense anger. I feel as though something has been taken away from me. How could she? How could Jess do this? What is wrong with her? Look at the life they have. Look how beautiful it is. I have never understood how people can blindly disregard the damage they do by following their hearts. Who was it said that following your heart is a good thing? It is pure egotism, a selfishness to conquer all. Hatred floods me. If I saw that woman now, if I saw Jess, I would spit in her face. I would scratch her eyes out. Evening. There's been a problem on the line. The 1756 fast train to Stoke has been cancelled, so its passengers have invaded my train, and it's standing room only in the carriage. I, fortunately, have a seat, but by the aisle, not next to the window, and there are bodies pressed against my shoulder, my knee, invading my space. I have an urge to push back, to get up and shove. The heat has been building all day, closing in on me. I feel as though I'm breathing through a mask. Every single window has been opened, and yet, even while we're moving, the carriage feels airless, a locked metal box.
I cannot get enough oxygen into my lungs. I feel sick. I can't stop replaying the scene in the coffee shop this morning. I can't stop feeling as though I'm still there. I can't stop seeing the looks on their faces. I blame Jess. I was obsessing this morning about Jess and Jason, about what she'd done and how he would feel, about the confrontation they would have when he found out, and when his world, like mine, was ripped apart. I was walking around in a daze, not concentrating on where I was going. Without thinking, I went into the coffee shop that everyone from Huntington Whiteley uses. I was through the door before I saw them, and by the time I did, it was too late to turn back. They were looking at me, eyes widening for a fraction of a second, before they remembered to fix smiles on their faces. Martin Miles with Sasha and Harriet, a triumvirate of awkwardness, beckoning, waving me over.
"Rachel!"
Martin said, arms outstretched, pulling me into a hug. I wasn't expecting it. My hands were caught between us, fumbling against his body. Sasha and Harriet smiled. They gave me tentative air kisses, trying not to get too close.
"What are you doing here?"
For a long, long moment, I went blank. I looked at the floor. I could feel myself colouring, and realising it was making it worse, I gave a false laugh and said, "Interview! Interview!"
"Oh!"
Martin failed to hide his surprise, while Sasha and Harriet nodded and smiled.
"Who's that with?"
I couldn't remember the name of a single public relations firm. Not one. I couldn't think of a property company either, let alone one which might realistically be hiring. I just stood there, rubbing my lower lip with my forefinger, shaking my head, and eventually Martin said,
"Top secret, is it? Some firms are weird like that, aren't they? Don't want you saying anything until the contracts are signed and it's all official."
It was bullshit, and he knew it. He did it to save me, and nobody bought it. But everyone pretended they did and nodded along. Harriet and Sasha were looking over my shoulder at the door. They were embarrassed for me. They wanted a way out.
"I'd better go and order my coffee," I said. "Don't want to be late."
Martin put his hand on my forearm and said,
"It's great to see you, Rachel."
His pity was almost palpable. I'd never realised, not until the last year or two of my life, how shaming it is to be pitied. The plan had been to go to Holborn Library on Theobald's Road. But I couldn't face it. So I went to Regent's Park instead. I walked to the very far end, next to the zoo. I sat down in the shade beneath the sycamore tree, thinking of the unfilled hours ahead, replaying the conversation in the coffee shop, remembering the look on Martin's face when he said goodbye to me. I must have been there for less than half an hour when my mobile rang. It was Tom again, calling from the home phone. I tried to picture him, working at his laptop in our sunny kitchen, but the image was spoilt by encroachments from his new life. She would be there somewhere, in the background, making tea or feeding the little girl, her shadow falling over him. I let the call go to voicemail. I put the phone back into my bag and tried to ignore it. I didn't want to hear any more. Not today. Today was already awful enough, and it was not yet 10:30 in the morning. I held out for about 3 minutes before I retrieved the phone and dialed into voicemail. I braced myself for the agony of hearing his voice. That voice which used to speak to me with laughter and light, and now is used only to admonish or console or pity. But it wasn't him.
"Rachel?"
"It's Anna." I hung up. I couldn't breathe, and I couldn't stop my brain from racing or my skin from itching. So I got to my feet and walked to the corner shop on Titchfield Street and bought 4 gin and tonics in cans. Then went back to my spot in the park. I opened the first one and drank it as fast as I could, and then opened the second. I turned my back to the path so I couldn't see the runners and the mothers with buggies and the tourists. And if I couldn't see them, I could pretend like a child that they couldn't see me. I called my voicemail again.
"Rachel, it's Anna."
Long pause. I need to talk to you about the phone calls. Another long pause. She's talking to me and doing something else, multitasking, the way busy wives and mothers do. Tidying up, loading the washing machine. Look, I know you're having a tough time, she says, as though she has nothing to do with my pain. But you can't call us at night all the time. Her voice is clipped, irritable. It's bad enough that you wake us when you call, but you wake Evie too, and that's just not acceptable. We're struggling to get her to sleep through at the moment. We're struggling to get her to sleep through? We, us, our little family, with our problems and our routines. Fucking bitch. She's a cuckoo laying her egg in my nest. She's taken everything from me. She has taken everything, and now she calls me to tell me that my distress is inconvenient for her. I finish the second can and make a start on the third. The blissful rush of alcohol hitting my bloodstream lasts only a few minutes, and then I feel sick. I'm going too fast, even for me. I need to slow down. If I don't slow down, something bad is going to happen. I'm going to do something I will regret. I'm going to call her back. I'm going to tell her I don't care about her. And I don't care about her family. And I don't care if her child never gets a good night's sleep for the rest of its life. I'm going to tell her that the line he used with her, don't expect me to be sane, he used it with me too, when we were first together. He wrote it in a letter to me, declaring his undying passion. It's not even his line. He stole it from Henry Miller. Everything she has is second-hand. I want to know how that makes her feel. I want to call her back and ask her, what does it feel like, Anna, to live in my house, surrounded by the furniture I bought, to sleep in the bed that I shared with him for years, to feed your child at the kitchen table he fucked me on? I still find it extraordinary that they chose to stay there. In that house. In my house. I couldn't believe it when he told me. I loved that house. I was the one who insisted we buy it, despite its location. I liked being down there on the tracks. I liked watching the trains go by. I enjoyed the sound of them, not the scream of an intercity express, but the old-fashioned trundling of ancient rolling stock. Tom told me it won't always be like this. They'll eventually upgrade the line and then it will be fast trains screaming past. But I couldn't believe it would ever actually happen. I would have stayed there. I would have bought him out if I'd had the money. I didn't, though. And we couldn't find a buyer at a decent price when we divorced. So instead, he said he'd buy me out and stay on until he got the right price for it. But he never found the right buyer. Instead, he moved her in, and she loved the house like I did, and they decided to stay. She must be very secure in herself, I suppose. In them, for it not to bother her. To walk where another woman has walked before. She obviously doesn't think of me as a threat. I think about Ted Hughes moving Asya Weville into the home he'd shared with Plath, of her wearing Sylvia's clothes, brushing her hair with the same brush. I want to ring Anna up and remind her that Asya ended up with her head in the oven, just like Sylvia did. I must have fallen asleep, the gin and the hot sun lulling me. I woke with a start, scrabbling around desperately for my handbag. It was still there. My skin was prickling. I was alive with ants. They were in my hair and on my neck and chest, and I leaped to my feet, clawing them away. Two teenage boys kicking a football back and forth 20 yards away stopped to watch, bent double with laughter. The train stops. We are almost opposite Jess and Jason's house, but I can't see across the carriage and the tracks. There are too many people in the way. I wonder whether they are there. Whether he knows. Whether he's left. Or whether he's still living a life he's yet to discover is a lie. Saturday, the 13th of July, 2013. Morning. I know, without looking at a clock, that it is somewhere between 7:45 and 8:15. I know, from the quality of the light, from the sounds of the street outside my window, from the sound of Kathy vacuuming the hallway right outside my room. Kathy gets up early to clean the house every Saturday, no matter what. It could be her birthday. It could be the morning of the rapture. Kathy will get up early on Saturday to clean. She says it's cathartic. It sets her up for a good weekend. And because she cleans the house aerobically, it means she doesn't have to go to the gym. It doesn't really bother me, this early morning vacuuming, because I wouldn't be asleep anyway. I cannot sleep in the mornings. I cannot snooze peacefully until midday. I wake abruptly, my breath jagged and heart racing, my mouth stale. And I know immediately that's it. I'm awake. The more I want to be oblivious, the less I can be. Life and light will not let me be. I lie there, listening to the sound of Kathy's urgent, cheerful busyness, and I think about the clothes on the side of the railway line, and about Jess kissing her lover in the morning sunshine. The day stretches out in front of me, not a minute of it filled. I could go to the farmer's market on the Broad. I could buy venison and pancetta and spend the day cooking. I could sit on the sofa with a cup of tea and Saturday Kitchen on TV. I could go to the gym. I could rewrite my CV. I could wait for Kathy to leave the house, go to the off-license, and buy 2 bottles of Sauvignon Blanc. In another life, I woke early too, the sound of the 804 rumbling past. I opened my eyes and listened to the rain against the window. I felt him behind me, sleepy, warm, hard. Afterwards, he went to get the papers, and I made scrambled eggs. We sat in the kitchen drinking tea. We went to the pub for a late lunch. We fell asleep, tangled up together in front of the TV. I imagine it's different for him now. No lazy Saturday sex or scrambled eggs. Instead, a different sort of joy. A little girl tucked up between him and his wife, babbling away. She'll be just learning to talk now. Or dada and mama, in a secret language incomprehensible to anyone but a parent. The pain is solid and heavy. It sits in the middle of my chest. I cannot wait for Kathy to leave the house. Evening. I am going to see Jason. I spent all day in my bedroom waiting for Kathy to go out so that I could have a drink. She didn't. She sat steadfast and unmovable in the living room. Just catching up on a bit of admin. By late afternoon, I couldn't stand the confinement or the boredom any longer, so I told her I was going out for a walk. I went to the Wheat Sheaf, the big anonymous pub just off the high street, and I drank 3 large glasses of wine. I had 2 shots of Jack Daniels. Then I walked to the station, bought a couple of cans of gin and tonic, and got on to the train. I am going to see Jason. I'm not going to visit him. I'm not going to turn up at his house and knock on the door. Nothing like that. Nothing crazy. I just want to go past the house. Roll by on the train. I've nothing else to do, and I don't feel like going home. I just want to see him. I want to see them. This isn't a good idea. I know it's not a good idea. But what harm can it do? I'll go to Euston, I'll turn round, I'll come back. I like trains, and what's wrong with that? Trains are wonderful. Before, when I was still myself, I used to dream of taking romantic train journeys with Tom. The Bergen line for our 5th anniversary, the blue train for his 40th. Hang on, we're going to pass them now. The light is bright, but I can't see all that well. Vision doubling. Close one eye. Better. There they are. Is that him? They're standing on the terrace, aren't they? Is that Jason? Is that Jess? I want to be closer. I can't see. I want to be closer to them. I'm not going to Euston. I'm going to get off at Whitney. I shouldn't get off at Whitney. It's too dangerous. What if Tom or Anna sees me? I'm going to get off at Whitney. This is not a good idea. This is a very bad idea. There's a man on the opposite side of the train, sandy blonde hair veering towards Ginger. He's smiling at me. I want to say something to him, but the words keep evaporating, vanishing off my tongue before I have the chance to say them. I can taste them, but I can't tell if they are sweet or sour. Is he smiling at me, or is he sneering? I can't tell. Sunday, the 14th of July, 2013. Morning. My heartbeat feels as though it is in the base of my throat, uncomfortable and loud. My mouth is dry. It hurts to swallow. I roll onto my side, my face turned to the window. The curtains are drawn, but what light there is hurts my eyes. I bring my hand up to my face. I press my fingers against my eyelids, trying to rub away the ache. My fingernails are filthy. Something is wrong. For a second, I feel as though I'm falling, as though the bed has disappeared from beneath my body. Last night, something happened. The breath comes sharply into my lungs and I sit up, too quickly, heart racing, head throbbing. I wait for the memory to come. Sometimes it takes a while. Sometimes it's there in front of my eyes in seconds. Sometimes it doesn't come at all. Something happened. Something bad. There was an argument. Voices were raised. Fists? I don't know. I don't remember. I went to the pub. I got onto the train. I was at the station. I was on the street. Blenheim Road. I went to Blenheim Road. It comes over me like a wave. Black dread. Something happened. I know it did. I can't picture it, but I can feel it. The inside of my mouth hurts, as though I've bitten my cheek. There's a metallic tang of blood on my tongue. I feel nauseated. Dizzy. I run my hands through my hair, over my scalp. I flinch. There's a lump, painful and tender, on the right side of my head. My hair is matted with blood. I stumbled. That's it. On the stairs at Whitney Station. Did I hit my head? I remember being on the train, but after that, there is a gulf of blackness, a void. I'm breathing deeply, trying to slow my heart rate, to quell the panic rising in my chest. Think! What did I do? I went to the pub, I got on the train. There was a man there, I remember now, reddish hair. He smiled at me. I think he talked to me, but I can't remember what he said. There's something more to him. More to the memory of him, but I can't reach it. Can't find it in the black. I'm frightened, but I'm not sure what I'm afraid of, which just exacerbates the fear. I don't even know whether there's anything to be frightened of. I look around the room. My phone is not on the bedside table. My handbag is not on the floor. It's not hanging over the back of the chair where I usually leave it. I must have had it, though, because I'm in the house, which means I have my keys. I get out of bed. I'm naked. I catch sight of myself in the full-length mirror on the wardrobe. My hands are trembling. Mascara is smeared over my cheekbones, and I have a cut on my lower lip. There are bruises on my legs. I feel sick. I sit back down on the bed and put my head between my knees, waiting for the wave of nausea to pass. I get to my feet, grab my dressing gown, and open the bedroom door just a crack. The flat is quiet. For some reason, I am certain Kathy isn't here. Did she tell me that she was staying at Damien's? I feel as though she did, though I can't remember when. Before I went out? Or did I speak to her later? I walk as quietly as I can out into the hallway. I can see that Kathy's bedroom door is open. I peer into her room. Her bed is made. It's possible she has already got up and made it. But I don't think she stayed here last night, which is a source of some relief. If she isn't here, she didn't see or hear me come in last night. which means that she doesn't know how bad I was. This shouldn't matter, but it does. The sense of shame I feel about an incident is proportionate not just to the gravity of the situation, but also to the number of people who have witnessed it. At the top of the stairs, I feel dizzy again and grip the banister tightly. It is one of my great fears, along with bleeding into my belly when my liver finally packs up, that I will fall down the stairs and break my neck. Thinking about this makes me feel ill again. I want to lie down, but I need to find my bag, check my phone. I at least need to know that I haven't lost my credit cards. I need to know who I called and when. My handbag has been dumped in the hallway, just inside the front door. My jeans and underwear sit next to it in a crumpled pile. I can smell the urine from the bottom of the stairs. I grab my bag to look for my phone. It's in there, thank God, along with a bunch of scrunched up 20s and a blood-stained Kleenex. The nausea comes over me again, stronger this time. I can taste the bile in the back of my throat, and I run, but I don't make it to the bathroom. I vomit on the carpet halfway up the stairs. I have to lie down. If I don't lie down, I'm going to pass out. I'm going to fall. I'll clean up later. Upstairs, I plug in my phone and lie down on the bed. I raise my limbs, gently, gingerly, to inspect them. There are bruises on my legs, above my knees. Standard drink-related stuff. The sort of bruises you get from walking into things. My upper arms bear more worrying marks. Dark, oval impressions that look like fingerprints. This is not necessarily sinister. I've had them before. Usually from when I've fallen and someone has helped me up. The crack on my head feels bad. But it could be from something as innocuous as getting into a car. I might have taken a taxi home. I pick up my phone. There are two messages. The first is from Kathy, received just after 5, asking where I've got to. She's going to Damien's for the night. She'll see me tomorrow. She hopes I'm not drinking on my own. The second is from Tom, received at 10:15. I almost drop the phone in fright as I hear his voice. He's shouting.
Jesus Christ, Rachel, what the hell is wrong with you? I've had enough of this, all right? I've just spent the best part of an hour driving around looking for you. You've really frightened Anna, you know that? She thought you were going to... She thought... It's all I could do to get her not to ring the police. Leave us alone. Stop calling me. Stop hanging around. Just leave us alone. I don't want to speak to you. Do you understand me? I don't want to speak to you. I don't want to see you. I don't want you anywhere near my family. You can ruin your own life if you want to, but you're not ruining mine. Not anymore. I'm not going to protect you any longer. Understand? Just stay away from us.
I don't know what I've done. What did I do? Between 5 o'clock and 10:15, what was I doing? Why was Tom looking for me? What did I do to Anna? I pull the duvet over my head. I close my eyes tightly. I imagine myself going to the house, walking along the little pathway between their garden and the neighbour's garden, climbing over the fence. I think about sliding open the glass doors, stealthily creeping into the kitchen. Anna's sitting at the table. I grab her from behind. I wind my hand into her long blonde hair. I jerk her head backwards. I pull her to the floor and I smash her head against the cool blue tiles. Evening. Someone is shouting. From the angle of the light streaming in through my bedroom window, I can tell I have been sleeping a long time. It must be late afternoon, early evening. My head hurts. There's blood on my pillow. I can hear someone yelling downstairs.
I do not believe this. For God's sake! Rachel! Rachel!
I fell asleep. Oh, Jesus. And I didn't clear up the vomit on the stairs. And my clothes in the hallway. Oh, God, oh, God. I pull on a pair of tracksuit bottoms and a T-shirt. Kathy is standing right outside my bedroom door when I open it. She looks horrified when she sees me.
What on earth happened to you?
She says, then raises her hand.
Actually, Rachel, I'm sorry, but I just don't want to know. I cannot have this in my house. I cannot have...
She tails off, but she's looking back down the hall towards the stairs.
I'm sorry, I say. I'm so sorry. I was just really ill and I meant to clear it up. You weren't ill, were you? You were drunk. You were hungover. I'm sorry, Rachel. I just can't have this. I cannot live like this. You have to go, okay? I'll give you 4 weeks to find somewhere else, but then you have to go.
She turns around and walks towards her bedroom.
And for the love of God, will you clean up that mess?
She slams her bedroom door behind her. After I've finished cleaning up, I go back to my room. Kathy's bedroom door is still closed, but I can feel her quiet rage radiating through it. I can't blame her. I'd be furious if I came home to piss-soaked knickers and a puddle of vomit on the stairs. I sit down on the bed and flip open my laptop, log into my email account, and start to compose a note to my mother. I think, finally, the time has come. I have to ask her for help. If I moved home, I wouldn't be able to go on like this. I would have to change. I would have to get better. I can't think of the words, though. I can't think of a way to explain this to her. I can picture her face as she reads my plea for help, the sour disappointment, the exasperation. I can almost hear her sigh. My phone beeps. There's a message on it, received hours ago. It's Tom again. I don't want to hear what he has to say, but I have to. I can't ignore him. My heartbeat quickens as I dial into my voicemail, bracing myself for the worst.
Rachel, will you phone me back?
He doesn't sound so angry any longer. My heartbeat slows a little.
I want to make sure you got home all right. You were in some state last night.
A long, heartfelt sigh.
Look, I'm sorry that I yelled last night, that things got a bit overheated. I do feel sorry for you, Rachel. I really do. But this has just got to stop.
I play the message a second time, listening to the kindness in his voice, and the tears come. It's a long time before I stop crying, before I'm able to compose a text message to him saying, I'm very sorry, I'm at home now. I can't say anything else because I don't know what exactly it is I'm sorry for. I don't know what I did to Anna, how I frightened her. I don't honestly care that much, but I do care about making Tom unhappy. After everything he's been through, he deserves to be happy. I will never begrudge him happiness. I only wish it could be with me. I lie down on the bed and crawl under the duvet. I want to know what happened. I wish I knew what I had to be sorry for. I try desperately to make sense of an elusive fragment of memory. I feel certain that I was in an argument, or that I witnessed an argument. Was that with Anna? My fingers go to the wound on my head, to the cut on my lip. I can almost see it. I can almost hear the words, but it shifts away from me again. I just can't get a handle on it. Every time I think I'm about to seize the moment, it drifts back into the shadow, just beyond my reach.
Megan. Tuesday, 2nd of October, 2012. Morning. It's going to rain soon. I can feel it coming. My teeth are chattering in my head. The tips of my fingers are white with a tinge of blue. I'm not going inside. I like it out here. It's cathartic, cleansing, like an ice bath. Scott will come and haul me inside soon anyway. He'll wrap me in blankets, like a child. I had a panic attack on the way home last night. There was a motorbike revving its engine over and over and over, and a red car driving slowly past like a curb crawler, and two women with buggies blocking my path. I couldn't get past them on the pavement, so I went into the street and was almost hit by a car coming in the opposite direction, which I hadn't even seen. The driver leaned on the horn and yelled something at me. I couldn't catch my breath. My heart was racing. I felt that lurch in my stomach, like when you've taken a pill and you're just about to come up, that punch of adrenaline that makes you feel sick and excited and scared all at once. I ran home and through the house and down to the tracks. Then I sat down there, waiting for the train to come, to rattle through me and take away the other noises. I waited for Scott to come and calm me down, but he wasn't at home. I tried to climb over the fence. I wanted to sit on the other side for a while, where no one else goes. I cut my hand, so I went inside, and then Scott came back and asked me what had happened. I said I was doing the washing up and dropped a glass. He didn't believe me. He got very upset. I got up in the night, left Scott sleeping, and sneaked down to the terrace. I dialed his number and listened to his voice when he picked up, at first soft with sleep, and then louder, wary, worried, exasperated. I hung up and waited to see if he'd call back. I hadn't disguised my number, so I thought he might. He didn't. So I called again, and again, and again. I got voicemail then, bland and businesslike, promising to call me back at his earliest convenience. I thought about calling the practice, bringing forward my next appointment, but I don't think even their automated system works in the middle of the night. So I went back to bed. I didn't sleep at all. I might go to Cawley Wood this morning to take some photographs. It'll be misty and dark and atmospheric in there. I should be able to get some good stuff. I was thinking about maybe making little cards, seeing if I could sell them in the gift shop on Kingly Road. Scott keeps saying that I don't need to worry about working, that I should just rest, like an invalid. The last thing I need is rest. I need to find something to fill my days. I know what's going to happen if I don't. Evening. Dr. Abditch, Kamal, as I have been invited to call him, suggested in this afternoon session that I start keeping a diary. I almost said, I can't do that. I can't trust my husband not to read it. I didn't, because that would feel horribly disloyal to Scott. But it's true. I could never write down the things I actually feel or think or do. Case in point, when I came home this evening, my laptop was warm. He knows how to delete browser histories and whatever. He can cover his tracks perfectly well, but I know that I turned the computer off before I left. He's been reading my emails again. I don't really mind. There's nothing to read in there. A lot of spam emails from recruitment companies, and Jenny from Pilates asking me if I want to join her Thursday night supper club, where she and her friends take turns cooking each other dinner. I'd rather die. I don't mind, because it reassures him that there's nothing going on, that I'm not up to anything. And that's good for me.
It's good for us.
Even if it isn't true. And I can't really be angry with him, because he has good reason to be suspicious. I've given him cause in the past, and probably will again. I am not a model wife. I can't be. No matter how much I love him, it won't be enough. Saturday, 13th of October, 2012. Morning. I slept for 5 hours last night, which is longer than I've done in ages. And the weird thing is, I was so wired when I got home yesterday evening, I thought I'd be bouncing off the walls for hours. I told myself that I wouldn't do it again, not after last time. But then I saw him, and I wanted him, and I thought, why not? I don't see why I should have to restrict myself. Lots of people don't. Men don't. I don't want to hurt anybody. But you have to be true to yourself, don't you? That's all I'm doing. Being true to my real self. The self nobody knows. Not Scott. Not Kamal. No one. After my Pilates class last night, I asked Tara if she wanted to go to the cinema with me one night next week. Then if she'd cover for me. If he calls, can you just say I'm with you, that I'm in the loo and I'll ring him straight back? Then you call me and I call him and it's all cool. She smiled and shrugged and said, all right. She didn't even ask where I was going or who with. She really wants to be my friend. I met him at the Swan in Cawley. He'd got us a room. We have to be careful. We can't get caught. It'd be bad for him. Life-wrecking. It would be a disaster for me too. I don't even want to think about what Scott would do. He wanted me to talk afterwards about what happened when I was young, living in Norwich. I'd hinted at it before, but last night he wanted the details. I told him things, but not the truth. I lied, made stuff up, told him all the sordid things he wanted to hear. It was fun. I don't feel bad about lying. I doubt whether he believed most of it anyway. I'm pretty sure he lies too. He lay on the bed watching me as I got dressed. He said, "This can't happen again, Megan. You know it can't. We can't keep doing this." And he was right. I know we can't. We shouldn't. We ought not to. But we will. It won't be the last time. He won't say no to me. I was thinking about it on the way home, and that's the thing I like most about it. Having power over someone. That's the intoxicating thing. Evening. I'm in the kitchen, opening a bottle of wine, when Scott comes up behind me and puts his hands on my shoulders and squeezes and says, "How did it go with a therapist?" I tell him it was fine, that we're making progress. He's used now to not getting any details out of me. Then, "Did you have fun with Tara last night?" I can't tell, because my back's to him, whether he's really asking or whether he suspects something. I can't detect anything in his voice. "She's really nice," I say. "You and she'd get on. We're going to the cinema next week, actually. Maybe I should bring her round for something to eat after." "Am I not invited to the cinema?" he asks. "You're very welcome," I say, and I turn to him and kiss him on the mouth. "But she wants to see that thing with Sandra Bullock, so..." "Say no more. Bring her round for dinner afterwards, then," he says, his hands pressing gently on my lower back. I pour the wine and we go outside. We sit side by side on the edge of the patio, our toes in the grass. "Is she married?" he asks me. "Tara?" "No, single." "No boyfriend?" "Don't think so." "Girlfriend?" he asks, eyebrow raised, and I laugh. "How old is she then?" "I don't know," I say. "Around 40? "Oh, and she's all alone. That's a bit sad."
I think she might be lonely."
"They always go for you, the lonely ones, don't they? They make a beeline straight for you."
"Do they?"
"She doesn't have kids then?" he asks. And I don't know if I'm imagining it, but the second the subject of children comes up, I can hear an edge in his voice and I can feel the argument coming. And I just don't want it. Can't deal with it. So I get to my feet and tell him to bring the wine glasses because we're going to the bedroom. He follows me and I take off my clothes as I'm going up the stairs. And when we get there, when he pushes me down on the bed, I'm not even thinking about him. But it doesn't matter because he doesn't know that. I'm good enough to make him believe that it's all about him.
Rachel. Monday the 15th of July, 2013. Morning. Kathy called me back just as I was leaving the flat this morning and gave me a stiff little hug. I thought she was going to tell me that she wasn't kicking me out after all. But instead, she slipped a typewritten note into my hand, giving me formal notice of my eviction, including a departure date. She couldn't meet my eye. I felt sorry for her. I honestly did. Though not quite as sorry as for myself. She gave me a sad smile and said, "I hate to do this to you, Rachel. I honestly do." The whole thing felt very awkward. We were standing in the hallway, which, despite my best efforts with the bleach, still smelled a bit of sick. I felt like crying, but I didn't want to make her feel worse than she already did. So I just smiled cheerily and said, "Not at all. It's honestly no problem." As though she just asked me to do her a small favour. On the train, the tears come. And I don't care if people are watching me. For all they know, my dog might have been run over. I might have been diagnosed with a terminal illness. I might be a barren, divorced, soon-to-be homeless alcoholic. It's ridiculous when I think about it. How did I find myself here? I wonder where it started, my decline. I wonder at what point I could have halted it. Where did I take the wrong turn? Not when I met Tom, who saved me from grief after Dad died. Not when we married, carefree, drenched in bliss, on an oddly wintry May day 7 years ago. I was happy, solvent, successful. Not when we moved into number 23, a roomier, lovelier house than I'd imagined I'd live in at the tender age of 26. I remember those first days so clearly. Walking around, shoeless, feeling the warmth of wooden floorboards underfoot, relishing the space, the emptiness of all those rooms waiting to be filled. Tom and I, making plans. What we'd plant in the garden, what we'd hang on the walls, what colour to paint the spare room. Already even then, in my head, the baby's room. Maybe it was then. Maybe that was the moment when things started to go wrong. The moment when I imagined us no longer a couple, but a family. And after that, once I had that picture in my head, just the two of us could never be enough. Was it then that Tom started to look at me differently, his disappointment mirroring my own? After all he gave up for me, for the two of us to be together, I let him think that he wasn't enough. I let the tears flow as far as Northcote. Then I pull myself together, wipe my eyes, and start writing a list of things to do today on the back of Kathy's eviction letter. Hoban Library. Email Mum. Email Martin. Reference. Find out about AA meetings. Central London, Ashbury. Tell Kathy about job. When the train stops at the signal, I look up and see Jason standing on the terrace, looking down at the track. I feel as though he's looking right at me, and I get the oddest sensation. I feel as though he's looked at me like that before. I feel as though he's really seen me. I imagine him smiling at me, and for some reason, I feel afraid. He turns away, and the train moves on. Evening. I'm sitting in A&E at University College Hospital. I was knocked down by a taxi while crossing Gray's Inn Road. I was sober as a judge, I'd just like to point out, although I was in a bit of a state, distracted, panicky almost. I'm having an inch-long cut above my right eye stitched up by an extremely handsome junior doctor who is disappointingly brusque and businesslike. When he's finished stitching, he notices the bump on my head. "It's not new," I tell him.
"It looks pretty new,"
he says. "Well, not new today."
"Been in the wars, have we?"
"I bumped it, getting into a car." He examines my head for a good few seconds and then says,
"Is that so?"
He stands back and looks me in the eye.
"It doesn't look like it. It looks more like someone's hit you with something,"
he says. And I go cold. I have a memory of ducking down to avoid a blow, raising my hands. Is that a real memory? The doctor approaches again and peers more closely at the wound.
"Something sharp. Serrated, maybe."
"No," I say. "It was a car. I bumped it getting into a car." I'm trying to convince myself as much as him.
"Okay."
He smiles at me then and steps back again, crouching down a little so that our eyes are level.
"Are you all right?"
He consults his notes. "Rachel." "Yes." He looks at me for a long time. He doesn't believe me. He's concerned. Perhaps he thinks I'm a battered wife.
"Right, I'm going to clean this up for you, because it looks a bit nasty. Is there someone I can call for you? Your husband?"
"I'm divorced," I tell him.
"Someone else, then?"
He doesn't care that I'm divorced. "My friend, please. She'll be worried about me." I give him Kathy's name and number. Kathy won't be worried at all. I'm not even late home yet. But I'm hoping that the news that I've been hit by a taxi might make her take pity on me and forgive me for what happened yesterday. She'll probably think the reason I got knocked down is because I was drunk. I wonder if I can ask the doctor to do a blood test or something so that I can provide her with proof of my sobriety. I smile up at him, but he isn't looking at me. He's making notes. It's a ridiculous idea anyway. It was my fault. The taxi driver wasn't to blame. I stepped right out, ran right out actually, in front of the cab. I don't know where I thought I was running to. I wasn't thinking at all, I suppose, at least not about myself. I was thinking about Jess. Who isn't Jess? She's Megan Hipwell. And she's missing. I'd been in the library on Theobald's Road. I'd just emailed my mother. I didn't tell her anything of significance. It was a sort of test-the-waters email to gauge how maternal she's feeling towards me at the moment, via my Yahoo account. On Yahoo's front page, there are news stories, tailored to your postcode or whatever. God only knows how they know my postcode, but they do. And there was a picture of her. Jess. My Jess. The perfect blonde. Next to a headline which read, "Concern for Missing Whitney Woman." At first, I wasn't sure. It looked like her. She looked exactly the way she looks in my head, but I doubted myself. Then I read the story, and I saw the street name. And I knew. Buckinghamshire police are becoming increasingly concerned for the welfare of a missing 29-year-old woman, Megan Hipwell, of Blenheim Road, Whitney. Miss Hipwell was last seen by her husband, Scott Hipwell, on Saturday night, when she left the couple's home to visit a friend at around 7 o'clock. Her disappearance is completely out of character, Mr. Hipwell said. Miss Hipwell was wearing jeans and a red T-shirt. She's 5'4", slim, with blonde hair and blue eyes. Anyone with information regarding Miss Hipwell is requested to contact Buckinghamshire Police. She's missing. Jess is missing. Megan is missing. Since Saturday. I googled her. The story appeared in the Whitney Argus, but with no further details. I thought about seeing Jason, Scott, this morning, standing on the terrace, looking at me, smiling at me. I grabbed my bag and got to my feet and ran out of the library, into the road, right into the path of a black cab.
Rachel? Rachel?
The good-looking doctor is trying to get my attention.
Your friend is here to pick you up.
Megan. Thursday, 10th of January, 2013. Morning. Sometimes I don't want to go anywhere. I think I'll be happy if I never have to set foot outside the house again. I don't even miss working. I just want to remain safe and warm in my haven with Scott, undisturbed. It helps that it's dark and cold and the weather is filthy. It helps that it hasn't stopped raining for weeks. Freezing, driving, bitter rain, accompanied by gales howling through the trees, so loud they drown out the sound of the train. I can't hear it on the tracks, enticing me, tempting me to journey elsewhere. Today, I don't want to go anywhere. I don't want to run away. I don't even want to go down the road. I want to stay here, holed up with my husband, watching TV and eating ice cream, after calling him to come home from work early so we can have sex in the middle of the afternoon. I will have to go out later, of course, because it's my day for Kamal. I've been talking to him lately about Scott, about all the things I've done wrong. My failure as a wife. Kamal says I have to find a way of making myself happy. I have to stop looking for happiness elsewhere. It's true. I do. I know I do, and then I'm in the moment and I just think, fuck it. Life's too short. I think about that time when we went on a family holiday to Santa Margarita in the Easter school holidays. I'd just turned 15 and I met this guy on the beach, much older than I was. 30s probably, possibly even early 40s, and he invited me to go sailing the next day. Ben was with me and he was invited too, but ever the protective big brother, he said we shouldn't go because he didn't trust the guy. He thought he was a sleazy creep, which of course he was. But I was furious, because when were we ever going to get the chance to sail around the Ligurian Sea on some bloke's private yacht? Ben told me we'd have lots of opportunities like that, that our lives would be full of adventure. In the end, we didn't go, and that summer Ben lost control of his motorbike on the A10, and he and I never got to go sailing. I miss the way we were when we were together, Ben and I. We were fearless. I've told Kamal all about Ben, but we're getting closer to the other stuff now, the truth, the whole truth. What happened with Mac? The before, the after. It's safe with Kamal. He can't ever tell anyone because of patient confidentiality. But even if he could tell someone, I don't think he would. I trust him. I really do. It's funny, but the thing that's been holding me back from telling him everything is not the fear of what he'd do with it. It's not the fear of judgment. It's Scott. It feels like I'm betraying Scott if I tell Kamal something I can't tell him. When you think about all the other stuff I've done, the other betrayals, this should be peanuts. But it isn't. Somehow this feels worse, because this is real life, this is the heart of me, and I don't share it with him. I'm still holding back because, obviously, I can't say everything I'm feeling. I know that's the point of therapy, but I just can't. I have to keep things vague, jumble up all the men, the lovers and the exes, but I tell myself that's okay, because it doesn't matter who they are. It matters how they make me feel. Stifled, restless, hungry. Why can't I just get what I want? Why can't they give it to me? Well, sometimes they do. Sometimes all I need is Scott. If I can just learn how to hold on to this feeling, this one I'm having now, if I could just discover how to focus on this happiness, enjoy the moment, not wonder about where the next high is coming from, then everything will be all right. Evening. I have to focus when I'm with Kamal. It's difficult not to let my mind wander when he looks at me with those leonine eyes, when he folds his hands together on his lap, long legs crossed at the knee. It's hard not to think of the things we could do together. I have to focus. We've been talking about what happened after Ben's funeral, after I ran off. I was in Ipswich for a while. Not long. I met Mac there, the first time. He was working in a pub or something. He picked me up on his way home. He felt sorry for me. He didn't even want... you know. I start laughing. We got back to his flat and I asked for the money and he looked at me like I was mad. I told him I was old enough, but he didn't believe me. And he waited. He did. Until my 16th birthday. He'd moved by then to this old house near Hocombe. An old stone cottage at the end of a lane leading nowhere, with a bit of land around it, about half a mile from the beach. There was an old railway track running along one side of the property. At night, I'd lie awake. I was always buzzing then. We were smoking a lot. And I used to imagine I could hear the trains. I used to be so sure. I'd get up and go outside and look for the lights. Kamal shifts in his chair. He nods, slowly. He doesn't say anything. This means I'm to go on. I'm to keep talking. I was actually really happy there with Mac. I lived with him for... God, it was about 3 years, I think, in the end. I was 19 when I left. Yeah, 19.
Why did you leave if you were happy there? He asks me.
We're there now. We got there quicker than I thought we would. I haven't had time to go through it all, to build up to it. I can't do it. It's too soon. Mac left me. He broke my heart, I say, which is the truth, but also a lie. I'm not ready to tell the whole truth yet. Scott isn't home when I get back, so I get my laptop out and Google him. For the first time ever. For the first time in a decade, I look for Mac. I can't find him, though.